Gordon Pasha and the Mahdi. This is an important insight into a key part of African history, the clash between Islam and Christianity. The extraordinary example of the clash of cultures and religions in Sudan came about in the latter part of the 19th century. The legacy of the English Christian general, Charles Gordon, or Gordon Pasha, as he's remembered in Sudan, and of the Arab Muslim Mahdi, Muhammad Ahmad ibn Abdullah, continues to influence Sudan to this day. Charles Gordon, whose life and death was destined to have such a great impact upon the history of Sudan, was born in England, 1833, the fourth son of a royal artillery officer, and his father had risen to be a lieutenant general. Charles was described as a resourceful and aggressive youngster with a keen eye and a fiery temper for injustice. At age 16, he entered the military academy, and at age 19, he began his training for the Royal Engineers. The engineers, an elite professional corps, it was the engineers who carried out the reconnaissance work, they led the storming parties, they demolished obstacles in assaults. They carried out rear guard actions in retreats and other hazardous tasks. General Gordon first saw action in the Crimean War, where the British and French were fighting against the Russians. Here he gained a reputation for fearless scouting of enemy positions under fire in the front lines, always returning with accurate field sketches and useful intelligence. Gordon was critical of the general lack of offensive spirit, and he is disgusted by those whose zeal was less than his. He wrote of the indescribable excitement of war, and he enjoyed it amazingly, and he was mentioned in dispatches because of his courage. After the war, he is appointed assistant commissioner to an international commission to survey the new Turkish-Russian boundaries as a result of the treaty. For 3 years, this preoccupied him in Bessarabia and Armenia. Armenia is where Noah's Ark landed, on the mountains of Ararat. Thereafter, Captain Gordon was sent to China, where he reconnoitred 400 miles of the Great Wall of China, and he also began a charitable fund for paupers. He contracted smallpox. He began to seriously consider eternal things. At about this time, Tin Wang, or the Heavenly King, as he called himself, inaugurated a new dynasty of perpetual peace by starting a vicious civil war. This is typical of terrorist revolutionaries. They speak about peace while they do the exact opposite. They talk about freedom while they oppress. Their terms mean the exact opposite. Dynasty of perpetual peace meant vicious war. Hundreds of thousands died at the hands of these Taiping rebels. Many were beheaded, crucified, or buried alive. Yet these so-called freedom fighters received widespread support from British liberals, with some writing ecstatic reports about these sober, God-fearing Wangs, the title they gave to the Taiping rebel leaders. In 1863, General Gordon, who then was a major, Major Gordon, was appointed commander of a Chinese mercenary force, which was optimistically named the Ever Victorious Army. So he was a British officer asked to lead a Chinese army. He took to the task of suppressing the extraordinarily successful Taiping rebels with ingenuity. And he needed ingenuity because these were a really tough, formidable enemy. He turned the enemy's two greatest advantages or assets to his own advantage. Because the Taipings were actually better soldiers and fighters than his own Chinese troops, he spared the prisoners' lives and enlisted the Taiping that he captured into his EVA, Ever Victorious Army. The many intricate waterways which serve as obstacles to advances, Gordon used as routes for supply and attack. Instead of seeing the rivers as a problem, he saw them as an opportunity. He utilized a large flotilla of small ships to transport his artillery and his infantry down the canals to outflank the Taipings and bring his guns to bear faster than they could if he was using land transport. Gordon believed it was the duty of a commanding officer to personally lead critical assaults from the front. This he did with calm courage and competence, sometimes seen with his hiking stick, walking in the front, leading the people into battle. In 16 months, he planned and executed 16 major offensives, capturing or destroying most of the Taipings and their weaponry. Amidst the battles, he rescued many an orphan, and at the height of one battle in Kwansan, he was seen carrying a child who he later educated, and this young boy grew up to be a senior police officer in Shanghai. Gordon succeeded in defeating the rebellion by aggressive leadership and by indirect tactics, with little loss to his own forces. He earned the reputation of being extraordinarily tough, working day and night, a man of courage, a man of resolution, a man, when necessary, of ruthlessness. He ended up a marshal in the Imperial Chinese Army. The emperor was so impressed with his achievements. But he refused literally a room full of gold as a reward. The emperor led him into a huge room full of gold and said, "This is your reward for saving the empire." And he refused. He said, "I need no payment beyond that of my British Army salary." And he returned in 1865 to England as a celebrity lionized by the press as Chinese Gordon. Now, his father's death in the year of his return to England revived his spiritual interests. And it was from 1865 that he dated his true conversion to Christ. Before this, he wrote that he had a belief that Jesus is the Son of God, and he used to have feelings of deep depression on account of my faults. "Now I know Jesus is my Savior. God made me count the cost and conclude that his service should be all. The fruits of the Spirit can only be had by abiding in Christ." Gordon gave himself wholeheartedly to Christian service in his community, visiting poor families, visiting sick people, visiting lonely people whom he befriended. For the rest of his life, he's involved in the relief of the sick, the suffering, the poor, and particularly the homeless orphans. His home, his family mansion, which he inherited from his father, now became a mission house. He ran a free school from his home where every evening he taught reading, writing, arithmetic, and history. There was also cricket, chess, and cheerful hymns. The scuttlers, as they called the young boys from the slums, normally arrived filthy and were washed by Colonel Gordon. Planting the freshly cleaned clothed boy in front of a mirror, Gordon would say, "Just as you are now a new boy on the outside, I want you to be new on the inside as well." He gave them a home, he gave them food, clothes, teaching, and a knowledge of God and his word, and he helped them find employment. After 8 years of such inner city missionary activity in England, Gordon was invited to replace Samuel Baker as governor of Equatoria in Sudan, the southernmost province of Sudan. His mission would be to establish order and to suppress the slave trade in the over 200,000 square miles of thornbush and swamp. Like Moses, who despised the riches of Egypt, Gordon refused the £10,000 a year which the king of Egypt offered him as a salary. Gordon said, "I only need £2,000 a year, thank you." And this contributed to the growing belief that Chinese Gordon was not quite sane. Who turns down a room full of gold and says, "I only need 1/8 the salary that, no, 1/5 the salary you're offering me?" Sudan at that time was a colony of Egypt, which in turn owed allegiance to the Ottoman Turkish Empire. So the Caliph Ismail, who was an Albanian Muslim who ruled Egypt, was himself a slave owner on a gigantic scale, as were his relatives and friends and ministers of state. But this was bad for his image in Egypt, because he needed investments from Europe. And so he instructed General Gordon to stop the slave trade in Sudan. Thus, the Caliph could continue to enjoy the services of his many slaves. At the same time, he could earn a reputation of being an enlightened leader opposed to the slave trade. Hypocrisy, nevertheless, an opportunity for General Gordon to do some good in Sudan. So he accepts this assignment. As governor of Equatoria, Gordon soon learned that most of the Egyptian soldiers had been sent to Sudan as a punishment. Stunningly unmotivated, these ill-clothed, ill-equipped, unpaid conscripts were never allowed leave lest they desert. So General Gordon is an interesting character that, as a British officer, he never commanded British troops. He commanded Chinese, he commanded Egyptian. He never had British soldiers under him, even though he became the most famous British general of the 19th century. Yet with such unpromising troops, Gordon still managed to suppress the slave trade, explore the Great Lakes, and introduce law and order to Equatoria. Now, the possession of slaves in Egypt, in Egyptian-ruled Sudan, was legal. This wasn't part of the British Empire. This was Egyptian Empire. He, as a British officer, was given leave to accept this assignment because the British supported the idea of ending the slave trade in everywhere they could, and therefore if their officer could help even a Turkish empire possession, he was allowed to do this. Slavery was easy money. Adventurers could easily obtain a loan, boats and slave raiders in Khartoum, sail up the Nile River, and with the partnership of some cooperative African chief, the slavers would raid a few villages at dawn, they'd shoot or spear a few people, the rest would be captured and the elders would be tortured to reveal where the hidden ivory was. This was the practice of the Egyptians in Sudan. Adults were secured with a shizba, a heavily forked pole, resting on the shoulders and the head secured by a crossbar, hands were tied to the pole. Of the survivors who reached Khartoum, females were allocated as concubines or domestic service. Most of the males became laborers or servants. The lucky ones became bazingas or slave soldiers, who then carried out further raids on others. The unlucky males were castrated for household service as eunuchs. This operation, performed in unsanitary conditions without anesthetics, was often fatal. Byproducts of the slave trade were cattle and ivory, captured or bartered, which were then carried back by the slaves. So they captured the slaves who would help carry the ivory that they poached in the hinterland up to. So they were getting money from both slavery and ivory. Evil trade. The average slaver could aim on capturing 400 to 500 slaves worth 5 to 6 pounds each, 20,000 pounds of ivory. That's about 10 tons of ivory, worth about 4,000 pounds in Khartoum a year. This thriving, stinking, fly-swarming city of Khartoum prospered on the twin trades of slavery and ivory. There was hardly an official in Khartoum who wasn't involved in both these trades. It would have been hard to find a household in Khartoum so poor as to not own at least one slave. Even the poorest Muslim had at least one slave. Even the most pious and humane Muslims couldn't see why Christians were making such a fuss about slavery. So here were the kind of rationales of Muslims to justify this evil trade. It might be wrong to enslave Muslims, they said, but the economics of Sudan requires a constant flow of fresh slaves, and the vast majority of these are pagan blacks, infidels. Could any reasonable man deny that the life of a Negro as a slave in Egypt or Turkey or Syria was infinitely preferable to his life in Equatoria or the Congo, where his life would be poor, nasty, brutish, and short? This was the common rationale in defense of the Islamic slave trade by Muslims. Obviously nonsense, but there we go. Gordon's first action against the slave trade was to nationalize the ivory trade, which denied slavers much of their profit. Then he closed the Nile River to slavers. But this, unfortunately, had the unforeseen result of immeasurably increasing the sufferings of the slaves. Instead of being crammed into a boat and shipped up the Nile, now they were being marched across the pitiless desert, where actually more died. Gordon then improved communications down the Nile, multiplied military outposts throughout Equatoria, and set about introducing the rule of law. It was a very personal administration. Justice was swift. Criminals were flogged. That's whipped. It was effective. It was popular with the people. Justice was seen to be done. It was done promptly. But it only worked because of Gordon's impartiality. Anyone less fair, less conscientious, it would have doubtless been abused. Gordon's was the first example of a foreign rule which could be fair, conscientious, and incorruptible. You couldn't buy Gordon. He had no interest in money. At Rajal, over 100 armed men of the Nyam Nyam tribe were reportedly occasionally cannibals. They surrounded Gordon after drumming all night advancing threateningly on him with their spears above their heads. He drew two guns and ordered them, "Now go." And they all left, and they left him alone. Another occasion, a mob of hostile Bury people were threatening Gordon, and as the witch doctors seemed to be performing some kind of curse ceremony on Gordon, he fired a shot on the ground next to him, and this ended the ceremony and the threat. They disappeared very fast. Gradually, movement became easier in Equatoria. People began to see they could receive justice, even against the governor's own servants. When Gordon began his work in Equatoria, its only exports were ivory and slaves. Slavers operate with impunity, with no fears or worries of any kind of justice. A healthy young woman could be purchased from her own parents for a packet of needles. By the time Gordon left, a respect for human life had once again returned to Equatoria. As the slave routes had now moved across the desert into Bahr el Ghazal, Gordon wrote to the Khedive of Egypt requesting the position of Governor General of the whole of Sudan, and this was granted. Gordon's Sudan was 1,640 miles long. It's about 2,000 kilometers long, more. About 660 miles wide, about 1,000 kilometers wide. His first task as Governor General was to see the whole of Sudan and to be seen by it. Within 5 months, Gordon rode over 5,000 miles, that's 8,000 kilometers, by camel, across the scorching desert, across the sand, the stony steppes, the wooded uplands, and the steamy swamps. He used thoroughbred racing camels capable of long journeys, going at an average of 7 miles an hour, almost 10 kilometers an hour. He owned a team of 5 camels so as not to wear anyone out, and he read books while riding at the trot. Redeemed the time. The desert strengthened his tendencies towards asceticism, meaning living a very Spartan, basic life, no comforts, and mysticism, which was already quite strong within him. I mean, he had a tendency to prayer, meditation, fasting. So in the desert, he did even more of this. As others before him had been prepared for their life works in the desert, think of Moses, think of Jesus. So now Gordon became even more spiritually attuned as he worked in the desert. And General Gordon enjoyed the drama of swooping down like some avenging angel upon some lethargic garrison of remote desert outpost of Egyptian troops, leaning forward in his high saddle, legs pressed on the camel's shoulders, as he's depicted in this later statue, this famous monument erected in Khartoum. During this camel tour of Khartoum and Sudan, Gordon suppressed the revolt. The robber chieftains of Bahr el Ghazal cowered in submission. He neutralized the largest, most dangerous slave trader, Suleiman Zawir. He dismantled half his slave army. He took the rest into his army without firing a shot. Gordon succeeded in breaking the back of the slave trade in Sudan with prayer, pressure, persuasion, and his overwhelming personality. He wasn't using force most of the time. He managed to ride into a camp of slavers and convince the soldiers to change allegiance to him, and would often have them then put the slave trader against the wall and shoot him. An extraordinary way of operating. Without drawing his sword or revolver, he could take over a whole garrison of slave traders. Remember, many of the slave traders' soldiers were slaves themselves. And so when they saw someone who would make a stand for them, many of these slave soldiers, who themselves had been kidnapped, but now they're being forced, and so he's won many of the slave soldiers onto his side to then take over and get rid of the slave traders. These experiences convinced him that there was no limits to what he could achieve by audacity and faith in God. It was quite common that people would attack him with knives and what have you, and he wouldn't even draw a sword or pistol. He'd take them out with his hands. In his writings, Gordon rebuked Christians for lacking in self-denial and devotion. A man must give up everything, understand everything for Christ. Gordon was ruthless with incompetent officials. He sacked many lethargic, corrupt Arab officials. He created momentous upheavals and disruptions in the administration. And when he investigated the prisons, he found them to be dens of injustice, with many prisoners detained for years, and they hadn't even come to trial. Gordon Sumner found the time to look into every case, and many people were let free. Corruption, false testimony, and incompetence had led many miscarriages of justice, which he endeavoured to reverse. He summarily had a notorious murderer hung, and the city was a lot quieter as a result. He had a man hung for castrating a slave. Many unjustly detained without trial, he released. In just 2 months, Gordon captured 12 slave caravans. One of these, after crossing 500 miles of desert, only had 90 of the original 400 slaves surviving. Few were over 16 years old, and some of the girls had babies, and there were many small children. He caught many of his own officials and soldiers involved in the slave trade. Now remember, he didn't have a British army. He's just surrounded by Muslim Egyptian soldiers. And yet he somehow manages to do all this, which is obviously against their religion, their views. And he got away with it by audacity, prayer, persuasion, personality. Gordon ordered that the governor of any district through which a captured slave train was found to have passed should forfeit 3 months of pay. When a Royal Navy vessel captured a large slave ship off Massawa, Gordon solemnly handed over 3 months of his own salary, so he subjected himself to the same rules. At Shaka, he expelled 100 slave dealers. 4 who were proven guilty of a massacre were shot. 14 slaves were rescued from a small party of 3 slavers whom Gordon had flogged. To tighten the blockade of Bahr al-Ghazal, the biggest slave exporting state, Gordon authorized the Baggara tribe to arrest all slavers. So he decentralized, gave incentives, bounty, put prices on the head. Financial problems now in Cairo precipitated a change in government. The ousted Khedive Ismail was replaced by Khedive Tewik, a Turk. This led to Gordon being replaced as Governor General. In other words, they basically said your services are no longer required, and he was let go, fired, dismissed, however you want to put it. Yet General Gordon left behind a transformed Sudan. He had abolished the Qurbah, the whipping of the soles of the feet for not paying your taxes. Imagine. He stamped out corruption. He freed many who had been unjustly imprisoned. He had freed many slaves. He had also remitted back taxes and provided piped water for Khartoum. He was popular in Equatoria as the man who had at least temporarily freed them from the Muslim North. However, he was resented, though respected by the Arab North. His prestige was higher than his popularity. Most Sudanese value the courage of a warrior very highly, and Gordon's courage was unquestionable. This may have been balanced along with the fact that they resented having a Christian govern over them, but they did respect his piety and his devotion. They may have deplored his attacks on the slave trade, but they appreciated his zeal, his energy, his integrity, the fact that he wasn't corruptible, that he saw justice being done. They admired Gordon more for who he was than what he had done. While Gordon was leaving Sudan, another leader was living as a hermit on the island of Aba, 200 miles up the White Nile from Khartoum. In May 1881, at the age of 38, Muhammad Ahmed ibn Abdullah proclaimed himself the Mahdi, the Mahdi. This was after years spent in prayer, fasting, Quranic study, and contemplation of the decay of Islam. The Sufi sect, you know, Islam is divided into 3 big mega sects. There's the Sunni, there are the Shiites, and there's the Sufi. Now, just broadly, excuse the analogies, but the Sunni are sort of like their Protestants. They're very much Quranic, what the Quran says, the book. The Shiites are like our Catholics. It doesn't matter what's in the book. The important thing is what does the leader say, the Ayatollah. They're the people of Iran today. The Sufi are more like the charismatics. The most important things you experience. They're the sword-swallowing, fire-breathing, miracle-a-day-keeps-the-devil-away crowd. So the Sufis were the mystical group. And so the Sufis predominated in Sudan. And the Sufi sect widely believed in the coming of the Mahdi, the expected one, an eschatological figure whose advent would foreshadow the end of the world. And the Mahdi would be a military messiah who would restore the glory of Islam and kill everyone else. Now the Sufi leaders and teachers were known as fakes. That's where the term comes from, a fake. You've heard the term, fake. Do you know where the term luck comes from? There is a goddess in Hinduism in India called Lakshmi. And so she's the goddess of prosperity. And so the British soldiers started to make a joke of good Lakshmi, which developed into good luck. And today when people speak good luck, they're actually using the name of a Hindu god or goddess, Lakshmi. We Christians don't believe in luck.
We are blessed.
We believe in God's blessing. We believe in God's grace. We believe in answers to prayer. We do not believe in luck. Luck is an English term that has developed from a Hindu deity or idol, Lakshmi. Now, a fake, and those are the Sufi leaders and teachers, the British soldiers started to speak about prison, you're a fake. And that came from the Hindu, from the Muslim Sufi leaders and prophets and teachers who were called fakes. And so the very term we have today of a fake, it comes from Sudan and from the Sufi sect. Interesting. And the disciples were called dervishes because they whirled around. And the dervishes widely believed that in the year 1300 of the Hijra, which is 1882 in the Christian calendar, the Mahdi would reveal himself. They were therefore predisposed to accept the claims of Muhammad Ahmad, who was a member of the Shaman order of Sufis. He came from the west of the Muslim world instead of from the east, but otherwise he has everything that a Muslim Mahdi should be. He is devout, he is learned, he descended from the Prophet, apparently, and he carried the sign of a mole on his right cheek, whatever that's got to do with anything. But there had been others claiming to be the Mahdi, but none came as close as Muhammad Ahmad to matching this prophecy. As the successor to the Prophet, the Mahdi claimed political authority over all Muslims and spiritual authority to restore the purity of Islam. He had chosen an opportune time to announce his uprising. There was widespread resentment of Turkish foreign rule, and many thousands had been bankrupted by Gordon's suppression of the slave trade. The fakes and dervishes responded to the religious appeal. The river tribes desired the return of the lucrative slave trade, and the Baggara nomads were basically against any government, because government means taxes, and we hate taxes, therefore, yep, if you want to fight the government, we're for you, because we hate all government. When the Mahdi forbade the paying of taxes to Khartoum and he announced the return of the slave trade, his popularity was guaranteed. The average Muslim was, yes, no taxes and we can raid Equatoria for slaves. Outstanding, we're for this. This is our leader. In imitating Muhammad, the Mahdi then made his Hijra retreat, because Islam dates the calendar from when Muhammad fled from Mecca to Medina, and that's where he built up his military forces to later take Mecca. So they date their calendar not from when Muhammad was born, not when Muhammad received the revelations or started his ministry, but when he retreated from Mecca to build up his military power in Medina. So the Baggara joined him by the thousands. Three expeditions sent by the Egyptian army to try and deal with the Mahdiists were annihilated, and the rebellion just flourished because now they'd captured all his weapons from this useless Egyptian army that they'd managed to beat. Meanwhile, there was a military coup in Cairo and a massacre of Christians by Muslims in Alexandria led to British naval bombardment. An expedition under General Gordon's long-time military friend, General Wolseley, to protect the Khedive and his army against the foreigners and the mob. So Britain had invested in Egypt by building the Suez Canal, which was very important for being able to let their ships get from the Atlantic through the Mediterranean, the Red Sea, into the Indian Ocean, because British India was a major, major part of the British Empire, and the shorter route to the east was obviously economically a great incentive. So Britain had invested a fortune in building the Suez Canal. And so although they didn't want Egypt, they needed to protect the canal. And so with a military coup threatening the stability of Egypt and therefore their canal, Britain gets involved. On the 13th of September, 1882, Wolseley routed the Egyptian army at Tel el-Kabir, And this began Britain's occupation of Egypt. Egypt was never a protectorate of Britain, it wasn't a colony of Britain, but it was somehow occupied by Britain temporarily. But this temporary occupation to protect their Suez Canal investment lasted 70 years. You know, when you get involved in military overseas adventures, it's amazing how long it lasts. Like the Zimbabwean army has been involved in the Congo for how many decades now? And why? Well, they got involved to protect some diamond mines up there that's being run by Mugabe. And if you ask the average Zimbabwean, why is your army still in the Congo? They couldn't easily tell you. Well, it was that sort of thing. Like the Americans getting involved in Afghanistan, Iraq. Why are we still there 13, 14 years later? Well, never mind. And when you get your soldiers involved outside, it's amazing how hard it is to bring them back again. Now, during this time that General Gordon was relieved of being governor of Sudan, he was appointed Major General and Commandant General of all forces in the Cape Colony in South Africa. So he was here in the castle in Cape Town. There was his office. When I was a soldier, I was summoned to the Commandant General's office into what used to be General Charles Gordon's office at the castle in Cape Town too, marched up the stairs in there, and so, what the hell are you up to, Hammond? And this was because of me running evangelistic outreaches and terrorist bases. What are you doing in SWAPO and ANC bases? What are you doing in PLO bases? You know, because they somehow knew about the work I was doing in communist and Muslim terrorist camps, showing the Jesus film, doing outreaches, and they wanted to check out what was going on with me. So I was marched up those same stairs into that office. That's where the Commandant General of the Cape was. The castle, the oldest building in the Southern Hemisphere, still standing and still operational. And there's General Gordon's office at the head of the stairs there. There we go, up those stairs. Gordon soon made strong, unpopular opinions known. The Boers, who had just thrashed the British army at the Battle of Majuba in the First Anglo-Boer War, the Boers were men after his own heart. They were brave, frugal, and pious. Now you can imagine, the British aren't too thrilled about suddenly finding their general, who's commandant of the Cape, actually supports the enemies, the Boers. And he said, well, they were right, and they were defending themselves, and we shouldn't have taken the Transvaal, and it was their country, and it was not a just war, a war of aggression. And so, because he was totally sympathetic to the side of the other side, you can imagine people getting furious. On this hill, mountain, Majuba, the Boers had beaten the British and killed their general, Colley, who was the High Commissioner of the whole of South Africa by the British, very high-ranking general, and the Boers had thrashed him in just a matter of hours. As for the Zulu, they've just had the Anglo-Zulu War, he was on the Zulu side too. He said, this was an aggressive war, it wasn't a just war, we shouldn't have invaded the Zulus. The Battle of Isandlwana was obviously a bad mistake on our part, and we shouldn't have been attacking him. Here's the Battle of Ulundi that took place just shortly before he came to the Cape. And the British had crushed the Zulu nation in a final battle in revenge against the Zulus having defeated the British at Isandlwana. And here's General Gordon, Major General Gordon, the Commandant General of the Cape, supporting the Zulus, saying, we were the aggressors and they were the defenders and we were in the wrong and they were in the right. One of his prisoners in the castle was King Kishwayo, who was exiled, and he was meant to be in the dungeon at the castle. General Gordon had the doors always open and King Kishwayo could wander anywhere around the castle. He could have whatever he wanted because General Gordon said, Kishwayo has been wronged. He did not deserve to be treated like this. And so he had evangelistic conversations with the exiled King Kishwayo. He arranged for him to visit England and go to see Queen Victoria. And she was persuaded to give him back his kingdom. And he was released from jail as a direct result of General Gordon. So General Gordon, you can imagine, he's a typical evangelical Christian. Christ comes first. My government and politics is way down the line. It's not as important as Christ's kingdom. And he looked at the Zulus and the Boers as people who had been wronged The British had been the aggressors. And so you can imagine, I think God was happy with what General Gordon was doing, but the British people were not happy with him. You can imagine. And so Gordon was also concerned for the spiritual welfare of the Boers and the Zulus. He had his evangelistic tracts translated into Dutch and Zulu. He distributed quantities around the countryside for the God-fearing burghers to study. Gordon's primary responsibility as Commandant General of Cape was to settle the Basutu border question. But during this time, he had dealings with Cecil Rhodes. And Cecil Rhodes said he found General Gordon a most extraordinary man, one who was disinterested in money. In other words, he couldn't be bought, he couldn't be bribed. And as a result, they said, Gordon's got to go. You can imagine. The businessmen can't bribe him. He's sympathetic to our enemies. He doesn't even keep Keshwara as a prisoner. He treats him like an honored guest in the castle. And so finally, General Gordon was forced to resign, and he complained, it's not possible to do anything with such a weak, vacillating government as what you have in Cape Town. And as somebody who lives in Cape Town, I can appreciate and understand what he's talking about. It's often that way in a big city, is it not? Now, at this point, General Gordon took long leave. He took a sabbatical, 1 year, first holiday effectively taken. And he went to the Holy Land, to Palestine, which is under the Turkish Empire at that stage, the Ottoman Empire. And during this year, he studied the scriptures and he did archaeological research, and he said it's the happiest year of his life. A routine of prayer, Bible study, and examining Jerusalem and other historic sites where Jesus had ministered in Galilee and so on. He set out to resolve through investigation. Now remember, he's an engineer. He set out to find the site of the crucifixion, and he identified Golgotha, which today is called Gordon's Calvary, or Gordon's Golgotha, and he identified the empty tomb, the Garden Tomb, which some people call Gordon's Tomb. Of course, it's not Gordon's Tomb. It's Christ's Tomb. Now, the funny thing is, the Roman Catholics have built massive churches and shrines over where they believe Jesus was crucified and where they believe Jesus was buried. And you can't recognize anything of the original site because they've got this massive edifice over it. But they never did Bible study or archaeological research to discover where it was. Gordon was the first one to do Bible study and archaeological research, and he identified, and today Protestants go to the undisturbed Garden Tomb. This has not been, if the Catholics or the Orthodox had found it, they would have built a whole church and shrine over it, and you wouldn't even be able to recognize what the site looked like. But the Protestants, by God's grace, have been shown by General Gordon's research the place to go. And so you have all the Catholics and Orthodox going to what they call the Holy Sepulchre, and the site, the Holy Sepulchre is the tomb of Christ, and that's buried somewhere under their big church there. But we can go to the Garden Tomb identified by Gordon because he studied the scriptures. And from here you can see Golgotha, which looks like the space of the skull, which has not been built on by the Catholics because they didn't do Bible study. They had a vision. Some monk had a vision and said, this is the place. And they built the edifice there. Isn't that wonderful? So General Gordon is the man who identified the places that Protestants go to see the place where Christ was crucified and where he rose from the dead. His book, Reflections on Palestine, was to him his most prized achievement. On the 8th of September, 1883, a British Colonel Hicks, in command of an Egyptian force of 10,000 unmotivated soldiers, marched into Kordofan. Kordofan is the Nuba Mountains, where we've done a lot of our work, in search of the Mahdi. On the 5th of December, his rabble was annihilated, along with himself and all his officers, and this military disaster placed Khartoum, the capital of Sudan, at risk. As Britain was occupying Egypt, it was now also responsible for Sudan. So Sudan was not a British colony, it was an Egyptian colony. But as Britain was running Egypt, because Egypt had fallen apart and they were trying to keep the Suez Canal together, they now were responsible for Sudan. But after Britain's humiliating defeat at the hands of the Zulus at Isle Wan in 1879, and by the Boers at the Battle of Majuba in 1881, the Liberal government of England wanted to stay out of Egypt and get out of Sudan. Majuba, which was such a humiliation for the British. Unwilling to send any army to relieve Khartoum, the Prime Minister Gladstone agreed to send General Gordon. Now, this is a typical political manoeuvre. They don't want to authorise an army to go there, but they've got to do something. So, a token. Oh, let's send General Gordon. Well, what can one man without an army do? Well, it doesn't matter. At the end, when they kill Gordon and float his body down the Nile, the British government can say, well, we did what we could. We sent Gordon. Yes, but without an army. And you see, the politicians, what is this? This is a token. A total of 21,000 Egyptian and Sudanese soldiers were scattered throughout Sudan, but they were confronted with 300,000 dervishes, or Mahdiist rebels, armed with modern rifles and artillery that they'd captured from Hicks's army. Without a British army, it was absolutely impossible that Gordon could put down such a vastly superior force as that led by the Mahdi. Yet General Gordon felt duty-bound to rally to the support of Sudan in its time of crisis. Appointed Governor-General of Sudan and ordered to evacuate all foreigners, Gordon arrived to an enthusiastic welcome in Khartoum. He immediately halved the taxes, abolished all tax arrears that people owed. He made a bonfire of tax records. You can imagine this assured his popularity. He then announced the independence of Sudan from Egypt. Now, of course, the British government did not send him out to do this. But he was an independent thinking man. He's the most famous British general of the 19th century of Victorian England. And governments hated him because he was a man of conscience. He did what he believed was right. He didn't follow the orders of the politicians. As Gladstone said, I don't trust Gordon. He treats a military command like a suggestion, and he always appeals to a higher authority. He gets his orders direct from God, not from me, the Prime Minister. So, you can imagine. He announces the independence of Sudan from Egypt. He appoints a council to rule under himself. He makes himself commissioner of Her Majesty's government, and then he seeks to have Britain declare Sudan its protectorate. Now, there's no way the British government wants to do this, but he is doing a very important move here. Being surrounded by the Mahdi's forces, he reported that an evacuation was impossible and he requested a relief column. They sent him to evacuate the foreigners from Khartoum. But he knew if he did that, the Mahdi's forces are just going to come and wipe out everyone else that's left in Khartoum. And so to protect the people of Khartoum, he stayed. Now once the land routes were cut off and even the telegraph was cut, Gordon stopped being a politician and he concentrated on being a soldier, especially an engineer. He brought immense reserves of courage, determination, and invention into improving the defences of Khartoum. He negotiated with the Mahdi by letter, and he strengthened the fortifications of Khartoum by digging a canal, a ditch, a rampart between the White Nile and the Blue Nile, and therefore he made Khartoum an island. Then, with ramparts, landmines, wire entanglements, he fortified. He also abolished customs duties and the pass system at the gates of Khartoum to encourage the villagers to bring more produce into market, which they did. He's got to prepare for a siege. Gordon converted the steamships into armoured warships with cannons. The steamers were used for sorties to break up enemy concentrations, for raids to capture cattle, and excursions to buy grain, which they needed to survive the siege. Gordon's defence was active, imaginative, and aggressive. He didn't just wait behind his walls for the enemy to act. Gordon himself engaged in sharpshooting to take out enemy snipers, and as the siege tightened, artillery duels with the Mahdi's forces were fought. During all this time, a groundswell of public outrage was brewing in Britain. Yes, the British Christians and the abolitionists, those who hated slavery, loved General Gordon. And Queen Victoria highly respected him. The government of England loathed General Gordon. In fact, they were hoping he'd just die and get out of their way. But the Times of London newspapers calling for prayers for General Gordon in imminent peril in Khartoum. Even Queen Victoria added her voice to the public demand for the British government to send a relief column. The outcry was motivated by humanitarian concern, commercial interests, admiration for Gordon's courage and dedicated duty, hatred of the Islamic slave trade, national pride being offended by being defeated by dervishes, and of course evangelical missionary fervour who wanted to see Sudan won for Christ. Finally, the British government had to send a relief column against their desires. Gladstone must have been furious. But General Wolseley, friend of General Gordon, was sent as the commander, but under serious restrictions which unnecessarily delayed their progress. Incredibly, several hundred of the Mahdi soldiers deserted and came over to join Gordon's starving besieged garrison. The British relief column smashed the Mahdi's forces of 10,000 dervishes at Abu Klea on the Battle of Abu Klea, 17th of January 1885, and this caused a lot of fear in the Mahdi's camp. Just after midnight on the 26th of January 1885, over 60,000 dervishes attacked Khartoum, swarming over the defences, overwhelming the thin line of weakened troops, many of whom were literally starving. The Mahdists poured into Khartoum and they slaughtered both soldiers and unarmed civilians indiscriminately. There are two main accounts of Gordon's death. The first account to reach Khartoum, by somebody who never even claimed to be there, had Gordon calmly, unresistingly being speared to death. As this was the first version to be published and as it has been immortalized in his famous painting, it's generally been accepted. However, two key eyewitness accounts, one by a bodyguard of Gordon and the other by a dervish warrior, agree that Gordon went down fighting. As the Mahdists broke into the governor's palace, Gordon stopped them in their tracks with revolver fire from upstairs. He then rushed a wounded man's aid, was hit in the shoulder by a spear. The enemy came on again. He fired until he ran out of ammunition, then lunged at them with a sword. The dervish shot him in the chest, knocking him back against the wall. He recovered again with his sword, beat back the enemy down the stairs, and at this point he was felled with a spear thrust to his right side. The unresisting Gordon might accord with contemporary pacifist notions of a martyr, but all his life General Gordon had been a fighter, and the weight of evidence is he died not like a lamb but like a lion. 2 days later, the British relief column arrived. 2 days late. The British public reacted with rage. The Queen sent a furious telegram rebuking the Prime Minister. Briefly, it was considered whether to press on and re-establish British prestige, but Gladstone's liberal views and his pacifism reasserted itself, and all British forces were withdrawn from the Sudan. 6 months after Gordon's death, the Mahdi died. A succession of poor harvests, epidemics, tribal wars reduced Sudan to misery. An attempted invasion of Egypt by the Mahdi's forces in 1891 was soundly defeated by the British. And in due time, 14 years later, with a conservative government in power in England, the time was chosen to avenge Gordon's death. Under General Kitchener, a vast Anglo-Egyptian army advanced up the Nile, crushed the Mahdist army outside Omdurman. Sudan was then ruled by an Anglo-Egyptian condominium. On the whole, it was the most successful and altruistic, meaning unselfish, of all Britain's colonial ventures. Britain gained very little, if anything, but the Sudanese people benefited a lot. In fact, the Sudanese people amongst whom I've ministered since 1995 speak of the time of British rule of Sudan as the only time they had uncorrupt, fair and efficient government. Nowhere was the departure of the colonial power regretted more deeply than Gordon's Equatoria. In fact, the day the British left, the war began with the Arab North, and it's continued to this day. When after independence the monument to General Gordon was overturned, there was a howl of protest from the older residents of Khartoum. Even a Muslim said he was a man of God. As with any great man, General Gordon received some vicious criticism from detractors who hate what he stood for and choose to assail his character. You should expect this. Any great leader is attacked. Some have tried to depict him as a drunkard, yet nobody ever saw him drunk. He did drink on occasion, but never in the field and never on safari, as he put it, when he's in the field. He reportedly never was immoderate. He was a Christian. He is an evangelical. Unlikely that he would ever have drunk to excess or to drunkenness, and no one ever saw him drunk in his whole life. He also gave up alcohol regularly, especially because of his work. It's very unlikely, extremely improbable, that he could have been a habitual drinker, even though Hollywood likes to depict that. At the cracking pace he worked, with as little sleep as he had, in the harsh climates he travelled in, with as many enemies as he had, neither his health nor his work nor his reputation in Sudan could have endured it. So, no, he was not a drinker. Others have attempted to portray him as a homosexual. This completely unsubstantiated slander is part of the homosexual community's strategy of claiming as many respected leaders of the past, like they even claim Alexander the Great, as a homosexual. Yet he has married twice and had children, and you know, where do they get this from? They're trying to get some respectability to the homosexual community by way of association. The fact that General Gordon was never married and that he devoted much of his time to rescuing orphaned boys from the streets is not evidence of homosexuality. But on that basis and that basis alone, they have speculated. Yet General Gordon was a strict Victorian Christian gentleman who wrote scathingly against the effeminate. He was appalled by the reprehensible sin of Sodom and Gomorrah in his own writings and speakings. Again, with the many enemies that he had, it's remarkable that not once in his 51 years of life did any of his contemporaries suggest any scandal except the fact that he had a disdain for money. The scandal was he turned down a room full of gold and walked away. He didn't accept £10,000 a year from the Khedive. He said, I don't need that. Just £2,000 will be enough for my expenses. Thank you. So that's the only scandal about it, was he didn't care for money. One criticism, which is true, is that General Gordon had a fiery temper. He did not tolerate incompetence. He did not tolerate indolence, laziness, or dishonesty. He was a tiresome perfectionist. Yet, as he is quick to wound, he is also quick to apologize. He never lost his power to compel love, fear, and obedience from those around him. And remember, he didn't have his own army. He was always in a foreign country leading foreign troops like Chinese or Egyptians. This means he didn't have the means to control without, in many cases, fear and intimidation. He had his faults, yet there's no doubt that he is a devout and sincere Christian. One of the greatest Christian generals of the 19th century. A courageous soldier, a compassionate leader who cared for the poor and the helpless. His legacy is seen in Equatoria, where Christian soldiers strive to follow his example by fighting for faith and freedom to this day. There, he is affectionately remembered as Gordon Pasha. If you go to St. Paul's Cathedral in London, you'll find the tomb of General Charles Gordon. I went there for Evensong in 2014 and visited this magnificent church in London, one of the most spectacular churches in the world, St. Paul's. And amongst the many great people buried in St. Paul's is General Charles Gordon. This memorial to Gordon. And you can see written on the side, to Major General Charles Gordon, who at all times and everywhere gave his strength to the weak, his substance to the poor, his sympathy to the suffering, and his heart to God. Born at Woolwich, 28th of January, 1833. Slain at Khartoum, 28th January, 1885. He saved an empire by his warlike genius, that's China. He ruled vast provinces, that's Equatoria and Sudan, with justice, wisdom, and power. And lastly, obedient to his sovereign's command, he died in a heroic attempt to save men, women, and children from imminent and deadly peril. Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. Now, notice, he wasn't obedient to the government of England, but is obedient to the wishes of his sovereign. Queen Victoria wanted him to save lives. Prime Minister Gladstone did not. So they've used the words very carefully here. Notice the monument has his hand resting on a Bible. And here is another monument to General Gordon in London on the Thames. And you can see him in thoughtfulness. And notice he has a Bible under his arm. He's holding the Bible in his left hand, and with his right, it looks like he's in prayer. Psalm 68, verse 31. Cush will submit herself to God. Now, what I've given you is a chapter in the Faith Under Fire in Sudan book, which is in your library. He's one of the great leaders, the victorious Christians who changed the world, one of the heroes of the faith. And we've included his audio lecture in Soldiers for Christ, which is, again, in your library. I give you this presentation, which is an unusual one in many ways, because we're focusing on a military leader, not a missionary. And yet he was a very evangelistic general. And his life and his experiences and the clash with the Mahdi is something that helps us to understand Sudan today and the clash between Christianity and Islam and the influence of British Christians in Sudan and why they were there and why the country to a large extent is as it is with a Muslim north and a Christian south. When he died, the Church of England started the General Gordon Memorial Mission to Sudan, and they planted many, many churches. For example, Bishop Gwynne, who, after whom our Bible College is named, the Bishop Gwynne Bible College in Sudan, he was one of the missionaries sent out by the Gordon Memorial Mission. So churches raised money to send missionaries to Equatoria, where he had worked, to evangelize the people he'd freed from slavery. So, to a large extent, what's going on in South Sudan, where you have the strong Christian belt in Equatoria, is a heritage of General Gordon. So, any questions, any comments? Questions, comments, complaints? Yes.
Yes, Dr. Thank you very much. My question is on the Muhammad. You say this. Muhammad received revelation and start his ministry.
Well, we don't suggest he received any revelation from God. We're saying he reported he received revelation from Allah.
My question is, Muhammad, how did he start his ministry?
Well, by claiming that he was the Mahdi, and he is the one who started the rebellion. So he first had to convince the people, I am the Mahdi, and secondly, he started to mobilize them in armies to attack a small outpost, get their weapons from the Egyptians, and build up this rebellion until he had a massive army of 300,000. So his ministry, if we've got to use that word, was a military uprising. The Mahdi is a military messiah, a Muslim military messiah, for want of a better word. Any other questions? Questions, complaints? Has anyone here been to Sudan or Egypt? Yes.
Yeah, Doctor. In your experience in the army, were there certain kind of people in your time that could stand against the command of the government in terms of saving their life instead of letting them die?
Indeed, there were. Not many. But let me say, you know one of them. Because Major General Shai Mulder was known for decades in the South African Army as a man who is first and foremost a Christian. And you could speak to him. Any soldier knew at any time, day or night, they could have access to the general. And he would speak to people on spiritual matters. He was known as the most evangelistic general in the South African Army. So your principal was one of those men who was brave. And he was also an engineer, like General Gordon, in fact, which is interesting. Engineers are the ones who must build the bridges and under fire and all that sort of thing, remove the mines. So yes, I knew of some good people. One person also, who is a good friend, Colonel Breitenbach, Jan Breitenbach. Now he's a fiery character too. Colonel Breitenbach, who I've spent a lot of time with, even in the field, he joined our mission for a time, was involved in the camps, courses, outreaches, and we did a mission to Southwest Africa, Namibia, and Angola, where I slept in a sleeping bag next to him for a month, working with him closely. Colonel Breitenbach was involved in the Suez Crisis conflict in 1956 as part of the British Fleet Air Arm. He was one of the first paratroopers in South Africa in 1960. He started the reconnaissance commander, our recce, He trained under the Rhodesian Special Air Service to learn how they operate, came down, replicated in the recce. He went into Angola during the Angolan War, Colonel Breitenbach, and went behind enemy lines and recruited thousands of black Angolans, Portuguese-speaking, ex-communists, and recruit them to join the South African Army. They became 3-2 Battalion, Buffalo Battalion. And they fought very well and effectively, indeed. He started 44 Parachute Battalion, he trained UNITA and a whole lot of others. Now, Colonel Breitenbach regularly clashed with the powers above. That's why he didn't become a general, because he stood up and spoke out to the generals so much that they were furious with him many a time. But he was such a hero. Had more medals, more battles than anyone else in the South African Army, Colonel Jan Breitenbach. So here's another rebel, you could say, and powerful evangelical Christian. Now, he wasn't a Christian all the way through his time in the army. He got converted later. In fact, he wrote to me and said that he's read the Christian at War book and he wants to join our mission. And so when he retired from the army, he came and joined Frontline Fellowship, and we did operations across the border, preaching to the communists. Colonel Breitenbach, here's just one. I was with him. He was on an outreach of ours on a frontline mission. We were at the headquarters of the South African Army and Southwest African Territorial Force in Windhoek, capital of Namibia, the bastion. So we've got what they call Big T. All the high commander there, from the general brigadiers all the way down to the junior officers. And so Colonel, I'd been asked to take the chaplain service, and I handed over to Colonel Breitenbach because he knew them. He knew their sins. He could preach to them like I could not. He stood up and he named names. Those were what they were doing. He named their sins. And you could see everyone, colonels, brigadiers, squirming. And Colonel Breitenbach, I mean, he was preaching straight and unveiling their sins that I didn't know about, because I was never high up in the army. I was a foot soldier. Colonel Breitenbach had them so in, you could see these people under deep conviction of sin and you know, really cringing. Afterwards, I had the Brigadier Gerrit Nell, who was second in command of Southwest Africa. He came up to me and he said, "We could never control Colonel Breitenbach when he was in the army. And just when we think we're free of him, he resurfaces under Frontline Fellowship." And yeah, we had these brave men. But you know, you get into trouble if you rock the boat. And there are people who have strength. Now, in the Second World War, for example, my professor at Baptist Theological College, now Baptist Theological Seminary, Professor Fritz Haus, he's a German soldier who fought in the Eastern Front and in North African desert, and he is under Erwin Rommel. And Erwin Rommel attended his Bible study and prayer fellowship. Now, my father was on the other side in the 8th Army under Montgomery fighting, who later became my professor and an honorary member of our mission. So Professor Fritz Haus was saying how Erwin Rommel would regularly tell him to ignore the orders from the high command. So, for example, the orders were for all soldiers on all sides, Allies, German, the whole lot. If you come across enemy forces in civilian clothes, they're not wearing uniforms, they're to be shot as spies. Commandos who were involved in assassination operations were to be treated as spies and shot. So the British sent by submarine SOE, Special Operations Executive, which is basically a terrorist organization. They did assassinations for the British. And this group of terrorists came in at night to try and assassinate the head of the German army in North Africa, Field Marshal Erwin Rommel, who was highly respected, the Desert Fox. And they failed. Now, those who were captured, according to the rules, because they'd come in as assassins behind the lines at night to murder, not trying to fight like soldiers in uniform, the order from the head of Germany at the time, Adolf Hitler, was execute them. And that would have been the order in Britain too. Churchill had the same order for any Germans who did that, if they did. So, in fact, they executed people who were just a spy who did nothing more than send letters back home with invisible ink on troop disposition and so on. So the British executed anyone they thought as a spy. Erwin Rommel said, no, you treat them like enemy soldiers, prisoners of war, you treat them well. And He even had formal burial service in the German war cemetery for the people who were killed trying to assassinate him. He is an honorable man. He said, no, we don't mistreat anyone. And this, you've always got Christian generals. And, for example, Erwin Rommel was a Christian general. Interestingly, the general on the other side, Field Marshal Montgomery, who my father served under, also had Christian convictions. He is son of a pastor, too. And he rebuked the British government for doing this, said, this is disgusting. We're fighting an honorable enemy. Sending in assassins at night to try and assassinate the enemy commander is just not on. It's against the Geneva Convention. We don't work like this. And he lodged an official complaint. So in history and in my own experience, I've come across officers who object. As a normal soldier, a foot soldier, I objected to different things. For example, once I remember asking to see the commandant, and the commandant had me marched in. Interesting that a normal soldier could ask to see the commander, but I did. And as I came in, the commandant said, what's on your mind, son? So I said, is it against the law to take the Lord's name in vain? Yes, son, it most certainly is, he said. Why? Are people taking my name in vain in this unit? I said, I'm very sorry to inform you, sir, that they are. And your non-commissioned officers are the worst offenders in this. He frowned and scowled and he said, I'm very sorry to hear about this. Leave it with me. I will deal with this. Next Friday, battalion parade. After the raising of the flag, national anthem, all that, let us read and pray. Commandant gets up to speak and he says, the Lord Jesus Christ is the commander-in-chief of this army. And any man who takes the name of the Lord Jesus Christ in vain is a traitor, and I will treat him as a traitor. It is God who determines whether we live and when we die, and how we die. Any man who takes the name of the Lord Jesus Christ in vain is undermining our war effort, endangering the lives of your fellow soldiers, and is a traitor. And he spoke along this line. Well, as we came off the parade ground, the staff sergeant started taking the Lord's name in vain, said, I don't bleep, bleep, bleep care what any bleep, bleep, bleep commandant says. I went to the law officer. I lodged a charge, which obviously you're asking for trouble because you're a soldier and you're laying a charge against an officer. Well, he lost his rank. The commandant was good to his order. He lost his rank, stripped down to the ranks. But there were people very angry at me for having done that. And so they had ways of getting to me. So the next thing was, I was put on two guard duties at the same time. And then I was charged for being AWOL from one. When I went before the same law officer, and I said, but I was standing guard duty at the same time elsewhere. He said, well, that's no excuse. Like you can be in two places at once. And so I was put into detention barracks and abused and beaten the way that they would deal with somebody who I'd made a stand. But of course, there were others who got me back for making a stand against their friend who was a blasphemer. So the battles like that. In the army, if you take a stand, you've got to expect consequences. And I got consequences. I remember a time up at the border when the unit, in pursuing a group of SWAPO terrorists, rode through somebody's mahangu field, flattened his plants and his fence in pursuing terrorists. So I reported this to the chaplain. The chaplain went to the commander, who sent the whole platoon back to repair the man's fence and to compensate him for the destruction of his crops. And that was made right. They said, well, we've got to make compensation. On another occasion, when I came across some SWAPO terrorist captured, being abused, reported it, and they immediately dealt with it, rectified and punished the people who did that. So we do know of cases where people making a stand have had a good result. But often there's prices to be paid because they may not be able to get you over that, but then some of these pagans there, they'll get you back in some other way. So you've got to be willing to take what comes If you make a stand, there will be consequences. And General Gordon knew, in disobeying his government, not evacuating the people, he's going to die in Khartoum. But he rather did that. He rather did the principal thing than take out the foreigners and leave the people of Sudan to suffer. He was actually playing an interesting game. I believe his whole motivation was to force the British government to come in and take Sudan, end the Muslim slave trade, and free the people of Equatoria permanently. And so I think he calculatingly chose to give his life, knowing it would force the British government to do what they wouldn't do otherwise. Come and really stamp out slavery in Sudan and free the people of Equatoria. So, yes, in fact, when a story is known, there's a lot of people have made a stand, but it's often the stories aren't reported. Yes?
Thank you very much, Doctor. I heard you mention about being involved in evangelical events and in different places of military camps. If today I was going to develop a desire to maybe establish some fellowships, maybe within the police sector, the armies, what would be the best way of doing it? You having that experience in the setup of the police and also the armies, like in Zambia we've got Zambia National Road, you know, those yeah. people. How effective can I be and how can I do it?
Thank you for that question. First thing is starting a Bible study and a prayer fellowship. That's the first thing I did. When I went in the South African Army, the first Sunday I asked the chaplain, may I speak? And it was the most terrifying thing I've ever done. I mean, my heart was pounding away. It was very, very intimidating. Your soldier with no hair, everything shaved off, stood up, turned to this hall of 500 men. We'd soon be down to 120 by selection. Others, if they didn't make the grade, they were shipped off to other units. But there was over almost 600, actually, that first Sunday. Most intense. We whittled it down in a matter of 3 months to just 120. But I stood up and I said, I love the Lord Jesus Christ with all my heart. And I want to honor him in my next 2 years here. If anyone else feels the same, please see me afterwards. Let's start a Bible study and a prayer fellowship. That's it. That's all I said. It was a terrifying stand to make, but I had to make it, and that's where our mission began. Frontline fellowship began with two men came up to me, Joe and Alex van Altenroos, twins, and we were the first three of this prayer fellowship. And then soon it grew. We were five, and six, eight, 12. By the end of our 3 months training, there were 12 of us meeting every night for Bible study prayer. At the end of our national, we were up to 24 at the end of our 9 months training. We're up to 84. By the end of our 2 years. So this Bible study and prayer fellowship grew. I believe the single most important thing any of us can do anywhere, whether it's your workplace, your school, your college, your hospital, wherever, you start a Bible study and a prayer fellowship. That's where everything grows from. And you'll discuss challenges, discuss problems, discuss the issues in the light of God's word. You read the scriptures, discuss the scriptures, apply the scriptures, pray the scriptures. And now we did it every night in the army. But for most people, that may be too much. Once a week is not too difficult. Some places, once every 2 weeks, maybe, if it's hard. But surely we can start somewhere. And maybe you start with once a month, once every 2 weeks, once a week, and maybe it can get more. But in the army, we found daily was very workable. And it was tremendous. And then my professor at Baptist Theological College, Professor Westhouse, says he had a Bible study and prayer fellowship every day in the Second World War, 6 years of the Second World War. And he said, even with the bombs landing overhead, we were meeting for Bible study and prayer. Incredible. What God can do, I think the Bible study and prayer fellowship are the heart of Christian work in almost any ministry situation. For example, in Eastern Europe, I was told by Dr. Paul Negrut, one of the top leaders in Romania. In fact, he's got the biggest theological college, Baptist Theological College, in the whole of Eastern Europe, Emmanuel University. But he suffered during the persecution years, and I was with him in the old days when the Berlin Wall was still up and we had to go through the Iron Curtain. He said to me, we do not count our members by who attends the Sunday service. We count our members by who attends the midweek Bible study and prayer fellowship. I think that's so true. Your real members are the ones who attend the midweek Bible study and prayer fellowship. You can do more deep work of discipleship in a Bible study and prayer fellowship than you can in a Sunday service. Sunday services are important. But it's in the interactive Q&A discussion, prayer time, we're all involved. I think the Bible study, or cell groups as some people call them, I think that's the heart of the church. Yes?
Thank you, sir. I'm asking on the point of Romans 13, where it talks about the authority is put by God and they are there for our good. So, my question is, how can we be parallel to obeying Romans 13 and at the same time, or in the meanwhile, opposing wrong authorities?
Good. Romans 13. Many people misread it. We need to see exactly what is in Romans 13. Romans 13 tells the government more than it tells us. Because in Romans 13 we read that the government is to be a minister of God. The word here in Greek is deacon. They're to be the deacon of God. And they are to be not a terror to good, but a terror to evil. They are not to be those who do you evil, the ones who want to do you good. He is the one who bears the sword. He is an avenger of wrath upon those who do evil. So he's to be one who brings terror to the evildoers, but he brings protection to those who do good. And he is meant to be a servant of God, and actually a servant and a protector of the people. So this isn't saying give to the government everything the government wants or demands. Jesus said, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. So if you think about it, when Jesus was asked, he said, you know, who's got a coin? Give me a coin. Whose image is this on it? Caesar's. Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. But today, many people's way of doing this is, render unto Caesar everything Caesar demands, and give God the coin. Exactly the opposite way around. What Jesus was saying is, Caesar deserves your taxes. It's his coin, you give him his coin. He gets the coin. God gets everything else. Today, Caesar gets your children to brainwash and indoctrinate in the schools and evolutionism, situation ethics, paganism, idolatry, and all the rest of it. And he gets everything, and then God gets a coin. Can you see how we've messed it up? It doesn't say you've got to submit to everything the government says. It says the government is not to be a terror to evil, a terror to good, but a terror to evildoers. They're to protect the law-abiding, they're to punish the law-breakers. There's another 13. Revelation 13, a beast that persecutes God's people. So when you've got a church being persecuted like in Sudan or in Northern Korea or in Iran or Red China, they look more like the beast of Revelation 13 than the servant of God, the minister of justice in Romans 13. So nowhere in the Bible does it give the government a blank check. We are to listen to our conscience, right? But can a conscience be wrong? Yes. There is a way that seems right to demand an end thereof is the way of death. Your conscience must be kept at the word of God to be effective. Should we submit to our parents? Yes. But what if our parents are abusive? I mean, you do get parents who are abusive. If a parent wants you to go into prostitution, help in crime, my parents forbade me to get baptized. And I went ahead and was baptized. You see, to respect your parents isn't always the same as to obey them. Must you respect your church leaders? Yes. But what if those church leaders are teaching heresy? What if they're involved in financial corruption? If they're involved in sexual abuse, immorality? Well, of course, there are false prophets in the church. There are false ministers in the church. There are false teachers in the church. You're not to submit to them. Could there be false servants of God in government? Well, in fact, virtually all of them are right now. So the idea that yes, God has instituted four governments: conscience, family, church, and civil government. All of them are under God. All of them are conditional. God doesn't give a blank check to any. And just as church government can be abused, so can civil government. So let's not be idol worshippers and say we give the government anything asked, whether right along. Right now, if the government says that they want to register churches, register religious practitioners, tell you which Bible colleges can operate, not, that's outside of the jurisdiction. They're meant to be dealing with crime, and they're meant to be dealing with justice and defense. They're not meant to be telling us what is marriage and who we can have as a minister or what is a Bible college. Good. Thank you.